Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
The old witch has positive associations, too. One of the most beloved crones in mythology is Hecate, the Greek goddess of witchcraft and necromancy. She is a highly powerful deity who today is often associated with the waning or dark moon. We should note that she didn't start out as an elder and was traditionally shown wearing a knee-length maiden's skirt. She later mutated into a threefold goddess, depicted sometimes with the heads of a dog, a serpent, and a horse. This triplicate form morphed into the Roman goddess Trivia, who oversaw the places where three roads crossed. Whatever her configuration, she is said to watch over boundaries, portals, and gateways, the in-between places, the land of liminality. With the rise of the modern Wiccan movement, Hecate eventually became conflated with the crone in the triple goddess paradigm, so she is now often seen in her guise as an old woman. These days, you'll find copious images of her cloaked with long white hair twisting from beneath her hood. Hounds usually accompany her, and she holds the keys of divine mystery. She's taken on the mantle of the Wise One, steeped in ancient secrets that she will reveal only to the worthy. One thing that remains consistent about Hecate is that she is frequently shown as a torchbearer. It was she who led Demeter through the underworld each year to bring Persephone back to the surface of the earth. It is also said that the words En Erebos Phos were inscribed above the main entrance to the interior of her temple in ancient Greece. These words translate to, in darkness, light. A worthy mantra for today's times, if there ever was one. Like Hecate, crones are often great helpers in stories. They are usually the ones who appear during a hero's quest to dispense advice, charms, and training. In The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell wrote, "For those who have not refused the call, the first encounter of the hero journey is with a protective figure, often a little old crone or old man, who provides the adventurer with amulets against the dragon forces he is about to pass." Some of my favorite fictional crone guides include Mrs. What's-It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch in A Wrinkle in Time, Augura, the astrologer in The Dark Crystal, and Joan Clayton, a.k.a. the Cutwife, in the television series Penny Dreadful, who is both an elder witch and an administrant of abortions. Each of them offers assistance or mentorship to the hero on his or her quest, and most often during moments of crisis and self-doubt. Rarer, though, are instances when the protagonist of a story is the crone herself. As I get older, I find myself soaking up positive depictions of aging with the thirst of a Jericho rose. One of my not-so-guilty pleasures is watching films that feature an older female protagonist who gets a second chance at life. Harold and Maude, Under the Tuscan Sun, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, Museum Hours. I want to know that there is an alternative road for me to walk, that I won't just shrivel up and disappear as so much of visual culture would have me believe. I want to know that vitality and self-empowerment are possible at any stage of life. Perhaps my favorite crone heroine of all time is Marion Leatherby, the deaf, toothless, 92-year-old protagonist of The Hearing Trumpet, a novel written by surrealist luminary Leonora Carrington. Marion sports a short gray beard that she finds, quote, rather gallant, unquote. And she has a dear geriatric friend named Carmela who states, people under 70 and over 7 are very unreliable if they are not cats. Thanks to a combination of witchcraft and lavish imagination, Marion embarks on an incredible mission to escape the old folks' institution her family sent her to. Throughout the tale, she is a magical, resourceful, and ultimately powerful individual, not unlike what Carrington turned into herself, as we'll see. These contemporary crones remind me that it's always a good idea to turn inward and connect with who I want to be rather than how I wish I looked. They also encourage me to embrace the aging process as having its own stately magic, as one becomes more adorned in experience, lessons learned, and wisdom to impart to future generations. Witches are written upon women's bodies, and so we must consider how the witch is worn. According to the National Retail Federation, the witch has been the number one Halloween costume for adults over the 14 years they've conducted their research, and I would wager it's been in the top spot for far longer. Though costume designer Adrian solidified our idea of witchwear via his designs for the Wicked Witch of the West in MGM's The Wizard of Oz, he was drawing upon much older iconography. Vintage photographs show women dressing up as witches in the decades leading up to the film, and a witch has been a go-to costume for parties, Halloween or otherwise, since at least the Victorian era. Ardern Holt's book, Fancy Dresses Described, or What to Wear at Fancy Balls, was so popular in the 1880s that it was published 6 times. It was an alphabetized compendium of costumes for well-heeled Victorian ladies, and it included this entry. Witch. Hubbard, Mother. Mother Bunch. Mother Shipton. Nance Redfern. Dame Trot. Enchantress, witch, and fairy godmother are all dressed much alike. Dame Trot wears pointed hat not so high. Nance Redfern, Mother Shipton, and the old woman who swept the sky, being witches, carry a broom, and on the skirt are toads, cats, serpents, curlews, frogs, bats, and lizards in black velvet. A serpent twisted round the crown of hat, an owl in front, a black cat on shoulder. Sometimes a scarlet cloak is attached to the shoulders, and the velvet bodice is high with pendant sleeves. Children's book illustrations, no doubt, had great influence upon the popular Victorian and Edwardian imagination, particularly those of fictional fairy tale and nursery rhyme author Mother Goose. Artists' renderings often feature her wearing a pointy hat, and interestingly, many have written about how her avian familiar signals that she may in fact be a light version of the Germanic winter witch goddess Holda. The first Mother Goose stories were published in 1697 by French fairy tale author Charles Perrault, under the title Histoire ou Conte du Temps Passé avec des Moralités, or Stories or Tales from Past Times with Morals, and the subtitle Conte de ma mère l'Oie, or Tales of My Mother Goose. And of course, these tales and subsequent nursery rhymes have been in circulation ever since, with Mother Goose's image being reinterpreted as many times as the stories themselves. By the end of the 19th century, English editions of Mother Goose tales from publishers such as McLaughlin Brothers and Henry Altemus Company showed her wearing a black pointy hat and often holding a staff or a broom. And Arthur Rackham's illustrations for the 1913 book Mother Goose, The Old Nursery Rhymes, crystallized her image as an old crone in a black witch's hat, riding a goose, cape flapping in the wind. But this still begs the question, what is the origin of this pointy chapeau? I've read several theories on this. Some people believe it to be a later iteration of the Judenhut, or Jew's hat, which Jewish people were forced to wear in medieval times. Others have written that during this time, many beer brewers were women, and they would wear tall, conical hats to stand out in the market. Incidentally, there are theories that the witch's cauldron and cat come from beer brewing as well, the former to brew the beer in, and the latter to scare away kitchen mice. I've also read that this pointy headwear was simply typical fashion of the medieval elite. Wiccan priestess Doreen Valiente wrote that it came from the copetaine, or French riding hat. Erica Jong wrote that it was the hat associated with heretics in the Middle Ages, and that between the 1440s and 1480s, the pointed henin hat of fashionable French women was considered devilish by clergy. The answer may be much simpler and rather more recent than all of this. According to historians Ronald Hutton and John Callow, the witch's costume, hat and all, comes from the traveling gear worn primarily by working-class British women in the 17th and 18th centuries. Hutton has pointed out that the Welsh national costume adopted in the 1820s includes a tall black hat as well. There is evidence that some upper-class British women wore this headwear too, per the unintentionally yet irresistibly witchy portrait of Mrs. Salisbury with her grandchildren Edward and Elizabeth Bagot, painted by John Michael Wright in 1675. This style of outfit was used later by artists to signify an outmoded woman who was a symbol of homespun traditions and archaic ways of thinking, and in the later case of Mother Goose and related characters Mother Punch and Mother Hubbard, old yarns. This illustrated witch was a parody of an old biddy or a country bumpkin then. A clown crone who fell anywhere along the spectrum between foolish and frightening, depending on context. And her outfit was further codified by popular drawings of the 18th century after the witch hunts had fully wound down. One of the most iconic depictions of a witch appears in a 1762 engraving by William Hogarth, entitled Credulity, Superstition, and Fanaticism. It's a piece that satirizes the blind faith of religion, specifically the Methodist movement. The piece shows a preacher lecturing his congregation about evil as he holds a marionette of a devil in one hand and in the other, a pointy-hatted witch riding a broomstick and suckling a feline incubus. This image made a huge impact on visual culture at the time, even though this witch herself is relatively miniature. She may well have set the standard for how we still see witches depicted in cartoons, books, and costumes today. This witch has also gone on to influence fashion, especially in recent years. Dozens of designers have borrowed liberally from her broom closet. Eddie Slimane's Spring 2013 collection for Yves Saint Laurent featured wide-brimmed black hats, filmy black chiffon dresses, studded black leather accessories, and a dark bohemian vibe that felt very Wicked Witch of the West Coast. Gareth Pugh's Spring 2015 ready-to-wear collection incorporated sequined pentagrams, pagan poppets, and horned animal skull masks. Alexander McQueen's line has consistently nodded to witchcraft and fairy tales since its inception, and current head designer Sarah Burton has carried on that spirit. Her fall-winter 2017 collection was inspired by the traditions of Cornwall and included thick, stitched ribbons reminiscent of a clouty tree, or wishing tree, and long, black folkloric dresses, as well as jumpsuits filigreed with silver tarot card imagery. Valentino, Rodarte, Ely Saab, Rick Owens, Mark Jacobs, Yoji Yamamoto, Iris Van Herpen, and Anne de Moulemeester are but a few more of the many clothing designers whose lines have riffed on witchly frocks, headwear, and practices over the past decade. And it's been heartening to see older women in recent fashion campaigns, often styled as glamorous mystical beings, from Joni Mitchell's groovy YSL Wise Woman in 2015 to Tippi Hedren's ultra-chic Gucci fortune teller in 2018. Now, the crone is couture. The witch is a muse for contemporary iconoclasts because she breaks the rules of propriety. She has little interest in satisfying the male gaze and often revels in rebelling against it. As Haley Phelan, the senior editor of Fashionista.com, told the New York Times about witch fashion, maxi dresses and capes are not really revealing a lot of skin. These designers are celebrating a kind of beauty that maybe appeals more to other women than to men. The fashion witch is powerful because she upends the expectations of female display in general. While she may be alluring, she's not inviting. Witchwear is wonderfully unwelcoming. It says, "Don't cross me." Or as Carmen Maria Machado put it in a November 2018 Harper's Bazaar article, witch fashion is, quote, "luxe meets feeling yourself meets fuck off," unquote. In wearing clothes that challenge the social contract of dressing to impress, one filters out any onlookers who may find her less than sunny exterior off-putting. She is the antithesis of the smiling blonde in the bikini. The witch fashions herself as strong and complex, not easy and pleasing. Her aesthetic evokes mystery and even mayhem as she subverts many of the things we're taught an attractive woman is supposed to be: passive, agreeable, a magnet for scrutiny. While a witchy wardrobe can certainly be sexy at times, it doesn't tend to prioritize body consciousness. More often than not, witchy fashion is about loose layers that veil the form or fabrics that cloak and cover. It conceals more than it reveals. It creates a shroud, albeit one emblazoned with spangles and talismanic symbols. And so the wearer is self-modulating and self-protected, a walking, woven spell. If she's shocking, it's because she wants to be. This witch is a voluntary disturbance. Women have been told over many lifetimes that their bodies are wrong and unbecoming, that they belong to other people. The fashion witch is self-possessed, first and foremost. She controls how much of herself she shows and shares. Whether others consider her anatomy a monstrosity or a thing of majesty is of little concern. She knows her body is her own, and that is true power. Chapter 5: Gifted Sisters and Shady Ladies. My hairstylist is also my tarot reader, and the efficiency of this pleases the pragmatic witch in me to no end. Every 3 months or so, I arrive at Amber King's Art Nouveau-decorated apartment and sit at her wooden table where we catch up on life and sip some warm herbal concoction she has brewed. We discuss how I've been, what I'm struggling with, and what I'm hoping to accomplish. And then the real ritual begins. She reads my cards with the gilded, crimped deck that she always uses and delivers messages to me about the state of my spiritual life with suggested next steps to take or things to be aware of. Then she washes my hair in the sort of kitchen bathtub that comes standard in so many old Manhattan apartments before sitting me in front of her mirrored vanity. Here, she gives me my cut and, as she first explained it to me, puts blessings into it that pertain to my reading. The whole thing takes around 2 hours and costs in total what either service would cost alone. More importantly, I always leave feeling better than when I arrived. Less weighed down by overgrown locks, sure, but also more subtly recalibrated. The reading and the haircut are two halves of a holistic magical working. Together, they align my interior and my exterior, ensuring that I feel balanced at every level. Going to Amber is an act of self-care and a metaphysical encounter. She reorients my inner compass, then clips off all that is no longer serving me, clearing the way forward. The cut is always lovely, but what I value most of all are the insights she offers me as she literally disentangles my head. I've come to think of her as my follicle oracle. If fears and fantasies about women's bodies have been linked to witchery, then the same is true of the female mind. Women have long been associated with supernatural abilities, from uncanny powers of knowing to extrasensory perception to a strong connection with the spirit world. Even outside of mystical contexts, a persistent idea of female intuition implies that women have some innate sense of awareness that men do not. Personally, I'm not convinced that this is true, even if women seem more sensitized to invisible forces or subtle emotional cues. This most likely has as much to do with socialization as biology. Perhaps people of all genders have the potential to be equally intuitive, but many men have been taught to suppress this because sensitivity has historically been linked to femininity and weakness. Regardless, the sentiment that women are more hardwired for otherworldly activities endures, and the current esoteric sphere seems to reinforce this generalization. The vast majority of spiritual consultants I've known over the years, the psychics, astrologers, energy workers, and fortune tellers of various flavors, have been women. At Lilydale, the community in upstate New York where people have been going to get messages from the dead since 1879, 40 of the 51 registered mediums you can currently visit with are female, about 80%. Of the 31 featured psychics on bestamericanpsychics.com, 23 of them, or 74%, are women. And of the 123 California-based psychics, tarot readers, and mediums I counted on bestpsychicdirectory.com, 99 are women, 80%. A more extensive study of gender and professional intuitives is outside the scope of this book, but I am willing to bet that the stats would remain fairly consistent. Though certainly not all of these people would identify as witches, there is overlap between what they do and what witches have been said to do throughout time. They are all supposed to have access to the great unknown and to provide stage directions from the spiritual world. Whether it's called a second sight, a third eye, or a sixth sense, it's usually women who are said to possess special abilities of knowing that can forewarn, inform, or illuminate. And no matter whether they're called witches, sibyls, oracles, or seers, women like these have sometimes been revered, but are frequently reviled. The idea that their strange gifts might give them an advantage over others or enable them to hold sway over the future has often been found unnerving, to say the least. "What do witches do?" ballet student Susie Banyan asks a professor in Dario Argento's 1977 horror film Suspiria. He explains, "They can change the course of events and people's lives, but only to do harm. They can cause suffering, sickness, and even the death of those who, for whatever reason, have offended them." The witches of Tann's Dance Academy live up to advance billing, and our Susie must destroy their leader, Helena Marcos, lest she be murdered herself. In the 2018 remake of Suspiria, the witches who run the ballet school have eerie mental capabilities. They can sense when their students are ready to perform occultic dance rituals, and they besiege the girls with nightmares. Their coven is devoted to a malignant deity called Suspiriorium, or the Mother of Sighs, and they sacrifice dancers' lives to keep her alive. Though these witches are charismatic and alluring in some ways, having Tilda Swinton playing one of their leaders, Madame Blanc, certainly upped their glamour quotient, they are wrapped up in dark magic, and their psychic powers are a key component in their evil plans. The fear of women with paranormal abilities has been with us for centuries. The Bible certainly doesn't mince words when it comes to witchery. Its most notorious remark on the matter is when God tells Moses during their Law of the Land debriefing, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Exodus 22:18, King James Version. Or as Leviticus 20:27 puts it, "A man also, or woman, that hath a familiar spirit, or that is a wizard, shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones, their blood shall be upon them." Or Deuteronomy 18:10, "There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch." Here is where things get linguistically squishy, though, because other English translations of the Bible use the term sorceress, or woman who does magic, rather than witch. Likewise, a person who hath a familiar spirit is also translated as medium or necromancer, as familiars were believed to assist them in communicating with the dead. All of this is to say that, according to the Old Testament at least, being a person with special powers was a deal breaker for the big guy in the sky, unless he bestowed the powers himself, which he usually did to men such as Moses. This meant that if you were an occult practitioner, the Lord's adherents would make sure you paid for it with your life. And yet, in the book of Samuel, one ghost-whispering gal is shown in a far gentler light. The story of the character who has come to be known as the Witch of Endor begins with Saul, the Israelite king. at a loss for what to do when his troops are surrounded by the Philistines, he implores God for guidance. God does not answer him, so King Saul decides to take matters into his own hands. He goes off with two of his men to consult a medium, hoping he'll have better luck contacting the spirit world. Only trouble is that Saul has forbidden mediumship and witchcraft in his kingdom. Talk about bad optics. So he dons a disguise and visits a woman who is still practicing necromancy on the down low. At first, she refuses him, thinking this is all a setup. She cites the king's eradication of spirit workers, telling her visitors, "Behold, thou knowest what Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Wherefore then layest thou a snare for my life to cause me to die?" Saul swears to God that no harm will come to her. "Whom would he like her to summon?" she asks. "The prophet Samuel," he tells her, and she complies. She then realizes that her visitor is, in fact, King Saul. She tells him that she sees a ghost come up from the ground like a god, and that he is old and wears a mantle. Recognizing her description, Saul realizes that the summoning has worked. Unfortunately, Spirit Sam is the bearer of bad news. First, he admonishes Saul for calling upon him, saying that if God won't help, then what the heck is he supposed to do about it? He then tells his brother that the Philistines are going to take over Israel, and that Saul and his sons are going to die the very next day. See you tomorrow. Saul falls to the ground, shocked from the news and weak with hunger. The medium insists on feeding him, butchering a fatted calf and whipping up some minute matzah, which she serves to him and his men. We don't hear more about her, so one can only assume that she goes on her merry necromantic way. She also keeps her reputation intact. Not only does she conduct a top-notch secret seance, but her hostess skills are aces too. Saul doesn't fare so well, as the ghost's vision plays out just as predicted. The next day, Saul's three sons are killed in battle, and after being wounded by arrows, he falls on his own sword. The Philistines overtake Israel. It's a morally curious story, to be sure, and one that mirrors our ongoing ambivalence about consulting with those who are plugged into the ethereal plane. I also can't help but feel royally pissed off at Saul's hypocrisy. Like so many lawmakers, e.g., congressmen who purport to be against Roe v. Wade, yet who have paid for their mistress's abortions, he is a secret consumer of the very services he has legislated against. Not to mention that he puts our witch in a chokehold of power dynamics. She has no choice but to comply with his request that she summon Samuel's spirit, even though she knows she is putting her life at risk. I used to read this story as an act of mercy on Saul's part and kindness on the witches. Now it strikes me as yet another tale of male privilege. It's about a man who has the power to change his own rules when it suits him, regardless of the vulnerable people he affects in the process. I like to think that when our Endorian heard the news of his death, she had a dinner of celebratory calf meat herself. Further examination of the Witch of Endor is interesting on another front, for she is never actually referred to as a witch in the Bible. Her original Hebrew description is Ba'alat Ob, which translates roughly to Mistress of the Ob. What is an ob, you ask? Interpretations vary, but it was most likely some sort of vessel or pit that would house a familiar or other ghostly entities. Sounds useful. It seems Our Lady of the Shades didn't come to be referred to as the Witch of Endor until many hundreds of years after her story was first written. In the Latin Vulgate Bible, which was translated by Jerome in the 4th century CE, this character is referred to as a Mulierum Habentum Pythonum. This term is derived from the Pythia, a high priestess in ancient Greece, most famously known as the Oracle of Delphi. A woman held this role from the 8th through 4th centuries BCE in the city of Pytho, itself named for the mythic serpent Python, who was slain by the god Apollo. One of the Pythia's primary functions was to enter a trance and channel words and prophecies from Apollo to those who sought her counsel. Due to twists of translation, the English terms Pythoness and witch eventually came to be conflated to mean any woman with uncanny powers, though in 16th century England, there still seemed to be a bit of a differential. The earliest occurrence of the phrase Witch of Endor is found in witchcraft skeptic Reginald Scott's 1584 book, The Discovery of Witchcraft. He also refers to her as a Pythonissa in the text, though his main point is that she was most likely a fraud who used some kind of elaborate ventriloquism to trick Saul, thus neither a witch nor an oracle at all. In 1597, King James I refutes this theory in his own witchcraft treatise, Demonology, in which he claims that witches are very real and very threatening indeed, but that our friend in Endor was rather more of a pythoness than a witch. Even Salvatore Rosa's famed painting, known in English as Saul and the Witch of Endor, has been given the title L'ombre de Samuel a présente à Saul chez la pythoness d'Endor by the Louvre, where it now hangs. Rosa most likely wouldn't have given it any title in his native Italian, as titling art was not a common practice during his time. But in a letter dated September 15, 1668, he describes the figure in the painting as the Pythonessa. It seems that a picture of a pythoness, and not a strega or a witch, was his original intent. Suffice it to say, though pythoness may once have had its own distinct meaning, the word has now fallen into disuse. I suppose witch has a better ring to it, and the fact that our biblical wraith raiser came to be commonly known as such is a testament to the ways in which the categories of various types of magic, divination, necromancy, spell casting, channeling, and so on, have been collapsed over time and shaken together in a grab bag marked witchcraft.
I put a spell on you because you're mine. Stop the things you do. I ain't lying. I can't stand no running around. I can't stand. Down.
I'm yours right now.
From the cradle bars comes a beckoning voice that sends spinning. You have no choice.
You hear laughter. Nothing to help. Watch me make them bow. One bite. pretty. I'm okay, I'm not your baby. If you think I'm pretty, you should see me in the crowd. I'm gonna run, there's nothing to hide. Watch me make them bow. One by, one by, one. You should see me in a crowd. Your silence is my favorite sound. Watch me make them bow. One by, one by, one. One by, one by, one.
Nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. The Senate's still corrupt, and the Emperor remains insane. And every day is a new strain of slaughter. Supply lines are less protected. Evil on all sides. I can smell the death on your flesh creeping in. Trapped within the twisting fingers of fear. And all I see is you. And all I see is you. And that face, and those eyes burning like leprosy. I can see you there, poisoning the air, prostituting nationalism. And I want to attack, to rip out your heart and lay you flat on your back and vomit a world of agony and truth into your throbbing illness of memory. And hate guides our way. And hate guides our way. I long for the icy slap of a belt across my back, for the acceptance of death and blind cave war, for the giving sleep of depression, the sweet elucidation of savage, meaningless aggression, chiseled into the meaty forearms of Mother Jupiter and his slave disciples. In the harem tents outside, just beyond the edges, I ride a cycloptic mare into the fires of imagination. Feeding my disease, a river of plagues. I need something to remind me I am still sinning, that pain is important, that words matter, that healing is possible, that I am not alone in this. Guard the houses. Triple the watch. Maidens, dig up your sorcery. Sirens, sharpen your rocks. You will eat my pain again.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.